wished and thought it was better, placing people on each side of the borderlines, and stories after stories have unfolded. In the autumn of 1914, the world's big powers were engaged in a bloody conflict for months because some did not like the borderlines set on the map at that time and were seeking little changes to them. Groups of young people, some on board ships, trains, and cars, and some by bicycles and horses, and even on foot, were dispatched from across the world to the front lines that were supposed to change the future of geographical maps. A war that was supposed to be concluded in a short period of time was dragging on with no end in sight. This is Sarajevo, a city whose strange events at the beginning of the 20th century decided the world's fate several decades later. Sarajevo is located in Bosnia that was annexed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire several years before the war. But the neighboring Serbia was opposed to the move because it was seeking to expand the Balkan region through uniting Slavs, and from 1914 onwards was creating unrest and insecurity in different Bosnian cities. But now, it was time to give a stern warning to the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. The long-awaited day was June the 28th, 1914, when Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austro-Hungary, was in Sarajevo on an official visit. Ferdinand and his wife were leaving Sarajevo's municipality when they were assassinated by 19-year-old Bosnian nationalist Gavrilo Princip. The young man had been armed by the Serbs. On July the 23rd, the Austro-Hungarian government demanded an investigation into the assassination, which was rejected by Serbia. In less than 3 months, the assassination made that time's big European powers engage in a brutal and complicated conflict. The two warring sides, in order to maintain their former positions, built trenches running parallel to one another that were 700 kilometers long and stretched from Belgian coasts to the Swiss Alps. The war pitted Germany as well as the Ottoman Empire and Austro-Hungary against France, Britain, and Russia. Soldiers on both sides of the battlefield looked more like miners than military troops. This way, each side blocked the other. Belgians opened their dams to drown German troops digging in inside the trenches. The winter was approaching and the trenches were gradually becoming cravens of ice, where troops sheltering inside were about to die. All roads were closed. Troops on both sides of the front were floundering in blood, constantly firing at each other. The Allies believed that the battlefield should be changed somewhere behind the enemy front where it could be stabbed in the back. One of these plans on the map was to gain access to Ottoman borders from behind. The Ottoman Empire had become a strong ally of Germany months after the start of the war and had turned into an effective force on the front line. Constantinople, which was previously called Byzantium and is now named Istanbul, was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire for more than 11 centuries and the capital of its successor, the Ottoman Empire, for over four centuries. In 1914 and prior to the First World War, Constantinople's population was around 1 million. They had different nationalities and languages, and most of them were Muslim, Greek, or Armenian. In those days, Europe's influence on the architecture of the newly constructed buildings and the clothing of people in Constantinople was quite clear. In those years, new political forces known as Young Turks were emerging in the Ottoman Empire. They formed a party called the Committee of Unity and Progress and turned the Ottoman king's position into a ceremonial one. The Ottoman borders had once extended to Crimea in the north, to Baghdad and Basra in the east, to the Persian Gulf coast in the south, to Egypt and North Africa in the west, and had stretched beyond Balkan nations in Europe and reached near Austria's Vienna. But the borders in the early 20th century were threatened by big powers from all sides. In 1914, the shrinking Ottoman Empire no longer ruled North Africa, Hungary, or much of southeastern Europe. The leaders of the Committee of Unity and Progress were sitting around the fire, feeling that hungry animals were prowling in the dark. The empire was shrinking more and more in the early 20th century. The leaders were trying to save the empire before it collapsed in the New World. Prior to World War I, they were making efforts to protect the remaining regions under Ottoman rule from further aggression through making an alliance with a big European power. Germany, under King Wilhelm II, had rejected the Ottoman demand for alliance. But after the war, it changed its mind on grounds that even the declining Ottoman Empire could have an impact on the fate of the conflict. shortly after the start of the war in November of 1914. And after the Ottoman Empire officially joined the war, its caliph, in the middle of regular demonstrations in Constantinople, declared war on Britain. While Ottoman troops were preparing to fight the Allies, Saudi deserts were chosen as the venue to infiltrate the Ottoman borders. Assistants of British Secretary of War Herbert Kitchener informed him that a person proper to accept ruling Muslims had already made contact. That person was the ruler of Mecca, whose name was Hussein ibn Ali. Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, was conquered by the Al Saud in 1902 and has remained their ruling center since then. But in the early 20th century, Riyadh was only a small part of the vast areas of Najd and Hejaz, which was ruled by the Ottoman Empire. Saudi Arabia was barren desert, and Hejaz was its most deserted and least attractive province. This region had a population of 300,000 people, half of whom were Bedouins and the rest were townspeople. Although Hejaz was part of the Ottoman Empire, its distance from Constantinople gave it a sense of autonomy. The distance seemed even longer in the absence of developed means of transportation and communication. The main product produced in Hejaz were dates that are said to have 100 varieties. However, the main source of income for people was the annual Hajj pilgrimage, which brought 70,000 pilgrims to Mecca every year. In 1908, Ottoman King Abdul Hamid II appointed Hussein ibn Ali as the Sharif of Mecca and ruler of Hejaz. The title of Sharif was given to an individual who was descended from Prophet Muhammad, and Sharif Hussein was from Hashim clan. After Sultan Abdul Hamid II was deposed by the Committee of Unity and Progress, a silent war gradually broke out between Sharif Hussein and the Young Turks as he was attempting to gain more independence in Hejaz. That was because full independence in ruling Hejaz, and especially ruling Mecca as the spiritual center of the Islamic world, would bring power which could tempt anybody to gain. Sharif Hussein was playing with both sides of the battle, the Ottomans and the British, to buy time and find a solution in future. At the same time, he was also consulting with his tough rival in eastern Saudi Arabia, Abdul Aziz bin Saud. Abdul Aziz was the leader of Al Saud and the Wahhabi sect. The place he had conquered in January of 1902 was a small village with mud walls, whose latitude and longitude was hard to determine by cartographers in the West. Riyadh was exactly located in the middle of the desert. Night of January the 16th, 1902, Abdul Aziz and 40 of his companions, using the darkness of the night, passed through the palm groves around Riyadh and crossed the high walls of the village. At sunrise, Abdul Aziz's forces entered the house of Riyadh's ruler, and a fierce fighting broke out between them. Finally, the ruler of Riyadh was shot dead by Abdul Aziz's fighters. After gaining power in Riyadh and its surrounding areas, Abdul Aziz demanded support from Britain. But in those years, the scorching dry deserts of Saudi Arabia, especially where Abdul Aziz ruled, were of little value for Britain to engage in clashes with the Ottomans. But now, everything was different compared with the years prior to the war, and the game had changed. In the late summer of 1914, Sharif Hussein's son, Abdullah, on behalf of his father, visited British intelligence chief in Cairo, Gilbert Clayton, and told him that Saudi Arabia was a hotbed of an insurgency. At that time, Abdullah intended to attract the support of a foreign power for fear that young Turks would topple his father. During those days, the topic of conversation in most Arab regions was the long-running debate on the identity of Arab-speaking people in the Ottoman Empire, a debate that emerged at cafes in Beirut and Damascus in the 19th century and spread to Paris neighborhoods where students lived. In fact, all the individuals attending these meetings in different Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire, from Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine to Iraq, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, felt threatened with the Committee of Union and Progress's tendency towards Turkism. Britain began investing in these people and meetings at the most sensitive period of time. In January 1915, British Secretary of War Herbert Kitchener, after getting approval from the Foreign Office and to attract Arab-speaking people, took even another step and ordered the British agency in Cairo to issue a declaration stating that Britain would not only help Saudi Arabians, but also all Arab speakers in Asia, from Palestine and Syria to Mesopotamia, gain independence.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe, can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Nikki Haley, the newly minted Republican presidential candidate, called on Wednesday, 15th of February, for mandatory mental competency tests for politicians older than 75, an implied dig at President Joe Biden and her one-time boss, former President Donald Trump. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, the newly minted Republican presidential candidate, has called for mandatory mental competency tests for politicians older than 75. Speaking at a rally in Charleston, South Carolina, kicking off her 2024 White House bid, Nikki Haley ran through a litany of political promises, including enacting term limits for members of Congress and cracking down on illegal immigration. But it was a vow to impose mandatory cognitive tests on older office holders that underscored the central message of her campaign, that the United States needs a younger leader after previously electing two of the oldest men to ever occupy the White House. In the America I see, the permanent politician will finally retire, Nikki Haley said. We'll have term limits for Congress and mandatory mental competency tests for politicians over the age of 75. Her remarks reflect a growing sentiment within both parties that their standard bearers, Joe Biden in the Democrats' case and Donald Trump for Republicans, are simply too old to continue on in the White House. Trump would be 78 by the time he'd be hypothetically sworn in again as president, while Joe Biden would be 82. Republicans in particular have repeatedly questioned Joe Biden's cognitive state, seizing on a series of gaffes to argue that he's not mentally fit to serve in the White House. Nikki Haley announced her campaign on Tuesday in a video posted online, becoming the first major Republican to mount a challenge to Donald Trump. Trump, who is once again seeking the GOP presidential nod. She's expected to travel to Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states to hold Republican nominating contests later on this week. While Nikki Haley may be one of the first 2024 candidates out of the gate, she still faces a rocky path to securing her party's nomination. For the time being, Donald Trump remains the GOP contest's ostensible front-runner, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appears to be the most viable alternative. Nikki Haley's support, meanwhile, is mired in the single digits. Haley has labelled herself a next-generation candidate in making her opening pitch for her 2024 presidential bid. She's also insisting that anyone over the age of 75 should be subjected to a mental competency test. It is a jab at President Biden, who will turn 81 in November, and Nikki Haley's 76-year-old rival for the Republican nomination, former President Donald Trump. The White House and Joe Biden allies say they understand that age and the president's mental competency will be at the epicenter of Republican attacks, and they're prepared to handle it. On Thursday, 16th of February, in a feisty response, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre offered a preview of how Team Biden will handle the attacks, pointing to 2021 when he proved his critics wrong and turned around the economy, and in 2022 when everyone predicted another red wave. Joe Biden, Karine Jean-Pierre said, beat them at their own game. British News of the Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley on Thursday defended her demand that politicians older than 75 who are past their prime get mental competency tests. When people send someone to Washington, they need to know they're at the top of their game. That's why I think those competency tests are important, she argued on Fox and Friends. Nikki Haley added, we can't have someone like Joe Biden who's asleep at the wheel and have China sitting there threatening us and us wondering if he actually knows what's going on. Haley made the pitch for competency tests in a 2024 campaign kickoff speech on Wednesday, 15th of February, in Charleston, South Carolina. The plan seemed to be aimed at both Biden, an 80-year-old, and former President Donald Trump, a 76-year-old, who until Haley jumped in Tuesday was the only Republican who had announced the 2024 presidential bid. Asked by Fox and Friends' Brian Kilmeade how Haley thought Donald Trump would do in such a test, his former ambassador to the United Nations said she believed the ex-president would pass the test. You know, I think he did great the last time he did it. I have no reason to think he wouldn't do well this time, Haley answered. But do I think we need it? She added that mental competency tests shouldn't just be given to presidents, but to aging members of Congress as well. Donald Trump famously boasted in July of 2020 that he asked his doctor to allow him to take a cognitive test to shut these people up, referring to those critiquing his mental fitness to hold office. It was 30 or 35 questions. The first questions are very easy. The last questions are much more difficult, like a memory question, Trump said in an interview with Fox News Channel. It's like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV. So they say, could you repeat that, please? And I said, yeah, it's person, woman, man, camera, TV. Okay, that's very good. If you get it in order, you get extra points, Trump explained. The former president then said that 10 minutes later he was asked to repeat the same words in order again and did so successfully. Can you do it? And you go, person, woman, man, camera, TV, Trump said. They say, that's amazing. How did you do that? I do it because I have good memory, because I'm cognitively there, he said. The clip went viral and was used for fodder by comedians in the United States. Joe Biden, meanwhile, was at the Walter Reed Medical Center on Thursday for his annual physical check, which was delayed by several months. When he previously received a physical check, his doctor made no mention of any kind of cognitive exam. During her kickoff speech on Wednesday, 15th of February, Nikki Haley argued, "It's not that America is past its prime, it's just that our politicians are past their prime. We won't win the fight for the 21st century if we keep trusting politicians from the 20th century," she added. 2 days into her presidential run, And Nikki Haley's main selling point has been that she, at the age of 51, represents a generational change.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene. Because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime.
Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Prothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwanda, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim or the hands of the victim back to the first public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people. For any small thing, you could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population. to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of, oh, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands and unsafe mines, and it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich natural resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tede is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Rain you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in the oldest method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule, proxy governments which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lua Lua, and Romelu Lukaku, their top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
U.S. detention centers are usually notorious for their lack of sanitation, medical neglect, and use of solitary confinement. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, earlier this month, over 85 people incarcerated at Northwest Detention Center NWDC in Tacoma, Washington, went on a five-day hunger strike to protest worsening living conditions. According to advocates, the strike started on February 1st when guards accused detainees of having some materials during an inspection. When detainees across units joined in protest, Immigration and Customs Enforcement (ICE) officers retaliated by tear gassing inmates in Unit F4 and using smoke bombs and pepper spray on others. Strikers demanded an end to this inhumane treatment, as well as access to better medical care and COVID-19 preventative measures, timely and warm food service, clean bedding and attire, lower telecommunications and commissary prices, among other basic necessities. Detainees ended the strike on February 6th after ICE officials promised to meet their demands. Though many say their food is still arriving late and other conditions have yet to be met. La Resistencia, a grassroots organization in Washington state led by undocumented people in solidarity with detainees at NWDC, is fighting to close the facility and end all detentions and deportations. Jose Hernandez, who was on hunger strike, told organizers with La Resistencia that he was fighting for medical attention and the rights of everyone detained at the facility. Hernandez told organizers, "I won't stop until I see results. This isn't just about me, it is about everyone." According to a statement from an ICE spokesperson, upon discovery of an inmate possessing a comb with razor blades used to color, the non-citizens involved refused to follow orders and became non-compliant. After careful